So if you look at Articles 15 and 16, we're still in the section of church order that deals with the office of the minister, or teaching elder, I think is the more appropriate term we should be using. Article 15, now the books you have will be worded slightly different. That's the church order of 16, 18, 16, 19. The HRC some few years ago adopted the redaction of 1914, reason being several of the articles were rooted in the Netherlands ecclesiology, and there was a lot of Erastianism, which means the connection between church and state was a little bit too tight for the North American perspective. So it was a bit of a trade-off. I still preferred and voted to keep the original because I thought it was better in some points, but so I have both actually in front of me, so when there are differences, I'll mention them. So Article 15, no one shall be permitted neglecting the ministry of his church or being without a fixed charge to preach indiscriminately without the consent and authority of synod or classis. Likewise, no one shall be permitted to preach or administer the sacraments in another church without the consent of the consistory of that church. Now, this article actually involves two issues. First, and this is a little bit, you know, again, slightly different than before, ministers who neglect the ministry of their own congregation and go around serving others without leave, that's one issue. So, you know, how a minister spends his time and where he does is not exclusively his to decide. And then the other issue is ministers who don't have a fixed charge. So that would be a man basically without a call. You know, under normal circumstances, that's not allowed by church order. So, you know, to serve other churches, you know, neglecting the ministry of his own church would be... And I think when I came here, if I remember right, well, actually, we should probably do this one of these days. We don't have any council decision about like how many Sundays I can preach elsewhere. So we have a leadership committee decision that's on the books. You know, so we probably should discuss that at some point to review that and see if it makes sense. But anyway, in Dutch church history, there has been what was referred to as free Sundays. Free Sundays would be when a minister would serve typically vacant churches, of which there were many in the Netherlands. So, you know, a consistory or church council would say, okay, we're going to give you 5, 8, 10 free Sundays, which means we will not have you preach at our church so that you can serve some of the churches that don't have a pastor at all. Typically what the local church would do would either read a sermon. Nowadays you have tapes, CDs, even videos. But that's kind of where that went. So this is saying, you know, the local church watches over that. That's the latter part of the article. No one shall be permitted to preach or administer sacraments in another church without the consent of that church. Here's the other one. Let me just save that. So, his church can't be neglected without the elder's approval locally. The fixed charge one, that's actually going, it came up last synod. I'm guessing somebody's going to probably bring it up this synod. You know, we have a man who hasn't had a call for a number of years. And the question is, even though he is serving churches, some within our denomination, some mostly outside, what is his relationship to the denomination? And I'm pretty sure it's going to come up for review because of this article. Now, he is operating under the auspices of a consistory, an HRC consistory, the oversight of them. He reviews his schedule with them. So it's not like he's just on his own. But being without a fixed charge is, you know, itinerant ministries without a call are frowned upon. Now, it came up last synod, you might remember that, where we agreed, okay, if the local consistory that oversees him wants to call him to this sort of work, so that he's a functioning minister of that local church, fine. That works. But if they don't call him, that's going to be trouble, because who then really is he a part of? Who then oversees him? Who then does he belong to? And that's an issue. So there's that. But the other part is you don't just go places without being invited by the elders. That's the latter part of the article. You don't preach or administer sacraments in other churches without the consistory of that church. I remember this being abused in my former denomination, where ministers would basically call up vacant churches and say, I'll be there at such a time. With the understanding you would be paying their preaching fees and their travel expenses. And they would not ask you. They would simply tell you. And ministers would serve other churches and basically tell their local church, I'm going to be gone this, that, and the other Sunday. So you'll need to find pulpit supply. Now that's a separate issue, of course. That's an imbalance and a total, you know, misunderstanding and perversion of the equality of the offices and who's supposed to be doing what. But this article actually, way back when, addresses that. So remember, we talked about the handshake at the beginning of the service and at the end, how it's symbolic of the ruling elders opening the pulpit privilege to the minister and closing it after he's done. And that symbolism represents it's not the minister's pulpit. It never belongs to him, even if he's the teaching elder of that church. The ruling elders are the ones who oversee what comes off that pulpit, and by virtue of that, they determine who stands behind that pulpit. So you're going to see on the agenda later, we talk about people giving pulpit supply for us when I'm gone, coming up this spring. I really want you men, especially you elders, to have more say. Now, in the beginning, you know, you didn't have that many people you were familiar with. I think now you kind of know people who've been here. You've seen how the congregation either responds favorably or doesn't. More and more, that responsibility I'd like to be giving to you, eventually to the point where, okay, we agree that I'm going to Zambia, let's say, on behalf of the HRC in April. You men would actually take the ball from there and say, okay, who do we think should come? Discuss with the deacons some cost issues that might be involved. And really, it's your call to aim for the edification of the church here, rather than me saying, okay, who can I scramble to get? And, you know, he hasn't been here in a long time. And it's very awkward for me to be making those decisions. Yes?
In relationship to students preaching.
Right.
God is basically the head.
Right.
So what is the relationship in having him provide pulpit supply, say, whether it's, you know,
right,
intrinsically, I mean, with Scott and his preaching,
yeah,
no heresy, very edifying.
Yep.
But what's the principle, you know, overarching that?
Right. Let me take his name out of it and just give you a general principle. Any student at the seminary, we have an arrangement with the seminary where I have contacted Hank and he discusses it with Joel, which seminary students are A, at the point in their studies where they're able to go out and preach, because you have to be at least 2 years through the program, have homiletics courses, exegesis, whatever, so you're competent. Then there's another layer where they know us, they know the HRC. It's like, who among that pool of people would be appropriate for this place? Because there are students who aren't necessarily thoroughly reformed, who we take in with the understanding they're not thoroughly reformed, and they come in knowing we teach thoroughly reformed, and don't make any bones about trying to move people in a reformed direction. Some students actually have to sign a waiver. Students who have Baptist leanings, that they won't propagate that belief among the student body, stuff like that. So there's that layer, and any HRC student is a member of the local HRC church there, so there's direct ecclesiastical oversight for life and doctrine. And then there's the oversight by the elders there and by the seminary staff over the preaching of these men. they get, you know, we're going to eventually move to this. Now that we have ruling elders, there are forms that you men can actually fill out critiquing the students' preaching, which is sent back to the seminary, which they very much appreciate, that address, like, you know, how understandable was it, how much did he preach the text, were the prayers edifying, a whole gamut of questions, so that the seminary knows how this is working out in the churches themselves. So I don't know if that totally answers your question, but there, it's considered part of their training.
So Scott is still under the auspices of the seminary.
Correct.
Yeah.
Until he's called and ordained, he's a student. Now, technically, he's called a candidate because he's been made by Synod eligible for call. So that's sort of a separate status. Whereas Marty, at this point, is not eligible for a call. Churches cannot call him because he hasn't been deemed callable by Synod. He hasn't completed enough requisites in their mind to deal with that. So you can see here, again, in this article, Article 15, how in Reformed Church polity, particularly Dutch Reformed Church polity, the authority of the offices is a local authority. Synod and more regional meetings like classis are a check and balance. Okay? So you have that tandem going on here. Any questions on Article 15? Okay, let's go to Article 16 then. The office of the minister is to continue in prayer and the ministry of the word, to dispense the sacraments, to watch over his brethren, the elders and deacons, as well as the congregation, and finally, with the elders, to exercise church discipline and to see to it that everything is done decently and in good order. Okay, this is basically a job description, a calling description of the minister. The first line, prayer and ministry of the word, you probably recognize as being taken directly out of Acts chapter 6. It was with these words that the apostles said, it's not reason that we should wait on tables, but we are going to devote ourselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word. So those should be the main aspects of a minister's work. Sadly, in the day we live in, ministers sometimes more resemble CEOs, administrators, a host of other job descriptions, but you know, the goal should be to remove anything that doesn't fit under these two categories. So that's why, for example, there was a time in New Jersey when I was serving there that the elders thought, well, maybe, you know, we'll give you a break from family visitation. I had a real issue with that, because to me, family visitation is the ministry of the word, you know, family by family in a very concrete, personal context. And you know, my rejoinder was, how on earth can I preach to people I don't know, or people I'm not up to speed with? And you know, I think here we have a little more leisure to see people more often than just the usual family visits, which I love, because then you really have a sense of ministry with the people you're working with. But, you know, having said that, you know, the downside right now is there's a ton of stuff that, you know, because you men work full time, because you have families, because of distances, living at distances, I do a fair amount of stuff that, you know, I just assume not do, that kind of ties things up. So eventually, you know, the more we can offload of that, the more I can, you know, work on things like radio ministry, work on track development, work on stuff like that. So that's line number one. And then it talks about, you know, dispensing the sacraments, of course. It's a firm principle in Scripture and church order that sacraments are not done by just anyone. I note with horror that the Roman Catholic Church has gone one step further since I left it, in the fact that now lay people can distribute the elements of the Lord's Supper to whoever. You know, the priest gives them a little box and off they go, and grandma, mom, sister, whoever, they now distribute the elements, which is, you know, incredible. And of course, they see the elements very differently than we do. which makes me even more amazed that they actually allow that. When I was still in the Catholic Church, we couldn't even have wine. They only gave us the bread. And that was centuries before that changed. So, you know, the sacraments, there isn't a single example in Scripture of the sacraments being partaken of without someone who God ordained being involved. Now, we went over with great care the breaking bread passages, and that was a different study we did, and how a lot of those, some of those couldn't possibly have been the Lord's Supper, to show that that expression doesn't always exclusively mean that. Some of them might have been. Some of them certainly were. Because that's all often brought up when this is mentioned. It's like, well, there's plenty of people who did the Lord's Supper in their homes, and they went from house to house breaking bread. It's like, okay, but what exactly was going on there? The next thing is watching over his brethren. So there is a mutual accountability, right? There is a practice we should probably start to adopt. It is just a practice. It's a tradition. It's called, we always refer to it by its Latin name, Censorum Morum. Censorum Morum is basically mutual accountability, mutual censoring. And that has traditionally been done, it doesn't have to be, but it's traditionally been done prior to the Lord's Supper. So the council meeting before the next Lord's Supper, you would typically go around the table and ask something along the order of, do you have any issues, words of encouragement, constructive criticism for any of your brothers here? And you would do that. Each person would be asked that question. And usually you would sing a psalm after you complete that, when everyone says, no, I don't have issues, or they only have encouragement for others, and speak that encouragement. And that gets put in the bulletin, that Censorum Morum was conducted, and rejoice that the Lord has given unity. And then by extension, we ask the congregation to do the same, to examine themselves, if there are any issues they have with anyone, to address them, to make sure our accounts are kept short, so that we can rejoice together. So that's something we definitely want to look to implement in time. It's, like I said, a tradition. We don't find it in Scripture per se, but it's been a very great blessing in the places I've seen it practiced. So then, so there's this mutual accountability among office bearers. And then notice how it says, as well as the congregation. So the oversight of the elders to some extent is shared by the teaching elder. And then the exercise of, I don't like the term church discipline, Christian discipline I would prefer, when it gets to the formal stages, is done in conjunction with the teaching and ruling elders together. And then that decently in good order, of course, is taken out of Corinthians. How the church should be that way. Now, I will say that, as we develop as a church council in Christian discipline matters, I see my role as bringing to the table principles that bear on the particular issue that we're dealing with. I see the ruling elders more in the lead when it comes to actually visiting people, working with them, confronting them. Depending on the nature of the situation, I might be along with, but sometimes it's actually more effective, with God's blessing, that the ruling elders actually take over the situation and deal with it. Now, I should mention, for the sake of our deacons here, that typically you won't know about Christian discipline issues until just before it reaches the stage, may God forbid, that the congregation gets involved. So we give you a heads up. What we will typically do as elders is, once the elders get involved actively, we'll simply mention that there is a case in the congregation that we're dealing with and we're at this stage. We won't mention names, we won't mention what the issue is, just so you're aware. But we actually safeguard you by doing that, so that if people for some reason would ask you, did you hear or do you know, you can honestly look them in the eye and say no. and the integrity of the Matthew 18 process is kept. I think most of you know we have a situation now. To this day, my wife still doesn't know either the people or the nature of the case. And I do that on purpose. A, she's not supposed to know. And B, it frees her to have a relationship with that person unencumbered with all the stuff that's going on. So we're not totally watertight in that situation, I'm finding out. But so far, the congregation, the people who do know, have done admirably well for the most part. Any questions on 16? Finn. Well, we can sure appreciate the wisdom God gave our fathers to make sure churches are safeguarded from some of the tendencies which crop up in churches to self-destruction.